The Coast 89.7 is proud to present the latest edition of our radio documentary series produced with the financial support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program. Curating Cape Breton's Multicultural Mosaic, a dedication to diversity past and present, is a Coast 89.7 original production. And now, The Story of Home with your host, Donnie Antle.
Welcome to The Story of Home. I'm Donnie Antle. In this episode, we visit the French colony of Île Royale. No one really knows who the first Europeans to visit Cape Breton Island really were. We know that Basque fishermen frequented our shores, fishing the rich waters of the Gulf of St. Lawrence, and the Spanish did as well. But the first Europeans to settle here permanently were the French. They named the maritime region Acadia, and they called this island Île Royale. Gabriel LeBlanc is the author of two books on the history of Île Madame, and has spent 40 years as an educator.
It was the custom in those days that when a parent moved on, that the farm was being subdivided to his kids, and really the subdivision didn't warrant a subsistence, so they had to move away. So the Cardinal Richelieu is the one that chose Daniel and Françoise to come into Acadie to start a permanent colony.
Some 60 families undertook the dangerous voyage across the Atlantic Ocean to settle in Acadia. Those first arrivals came from the western portions of France and brought with them valuable skills to the New World.
Also in the region of Poitou, where the majority of the Acadians originate, they were people that had the engineering ability, really, and the knowledge of the dikes. So when they did come to the Anapas Valley area, they were able to extract really very fertile land from salt water. So in French, they were known as les défricheurs d'eau salée, which meant that they pushed the salt water out and they farmed the land. And it became very, very fertile. And they were very prosperous because they traded with everybody. And of course, they were the envy of a lot of what you would call planters, New Englanders, especially around the War of Independence, because they knew that the jig was up. The Patriots were going to take over the U.S. The Loyalists, they didn't want to go to England because they didn't want to go back to the old system. And they wanted to stay under British crown, so this was one of the reasons. And one of our friends, John Mac Farringer, wrote in his book, he was really the historian from Yale University, that there was a connection between the expulsion and these planters wanting the land and live under the British crown. And it was not because of didn't want to take the oath. That's that it was more tangible or believable, really, a scenario.
It is these first settlers that form the root of Acadian culture, distinct from their native France. Sarah McGinnis is a historian at the Fortress of Louisbourg National Park.
The Acadian population, as we view it, starts as this group that comes over and settles in the region of Acadia, which is in the mainland of Nova Scotia and into New Brunswick. And really, they develop as they're just as a distinct cultural group apart from French colonials, and really the culture for the Acadians is really heavily based on farming, whereas other French colonists at the time focus on other elements of colonization. So you've got trade and fisheries, that kind of thing, in other locations throughout French North America at the time.
Naturally, some of the more adventurous Acadians decided to make a home on the island.
Well, there were some Acadians in Cape Breton around 1640. Mm-hmm. They came as workers for Nicolas Denis, who had set up Port Toulouse. Okay. And, of course, they fished off here, Île Madame. And the reason, because the banks for you get this cod was really near to the shore from Île Madame. Mm-hmm. And they were able to really get a living out of it. And also Nicolas Denis had the rights to the natural resources of Cape Breton Island and eastern Nova Scotia at the time from the King of France. So they came working for him. And of course, they stayed. And as it evolved, and especially around 1720 with the construction of Louisbourg, there was more people coming in. Because during the construction and the maintenance of Louisbourg, there were employment in all sectors of the economy. You know, Lower River inhabitants of the river there had two sawmills that just cut for the construction of Louisbourg. There was a quarry next to Port Hood that were where they cut rock for Louisbourg. Here we had two sieurs from Quebec, Sieur Jombert and Sieur d'Hôtel, who came to set up a seigneury here on Isle Madame, and that was to provide food for Louisbourg. We had a Dugas, a descendant from the Dugas in West Arshad. He had the contract for firewood for Louisbourg, and he amassed quite a considerable fortune. And there was a Leblanc there, a player, Joseph Lemaigre. He was one of our descendants, and he was a kind of a renegade, and he traded when he wasn't supposed to and ran contraband. But he amassed quite a bit of a fortune trading with Louisbourg, because the British had really, prevented the Acadians to trade with Louisbourg under any condition. Mm-hmm. And this fellow here used to buy cattle from Annapolis Royal, take them through the woods to through the Bay of Chenecto and to the Northumberland Strait, where he'd load them up and take them to Louisbourg to sell. So him and the First Nations, the Mi'kmaq. Mm-hmm. So with that happening, you see more and more Acadians. There was over 400 Acadians in Louisbourg around 1720.
For a people used to the mild, temperate climate of France, the first winter on Cape Breton's shores came as an unpleasant shock.
That first winter at Louisbourg, for us, is kind of unimaginable. Winter here sets in pretty early. So to arrive on the shores here in 1713, there hadn't really been any permanent settlement here of any kind before that. And you've got a group of people who really have to make the most of everything that's around them with limited supplies for the winter. And it's not until May of the next year that supply ships get through. So we talk about this a lot here at Louisbourg, but really that effort to make that work in that first winter is really admirable and amazing. It's amazing that we're still here.
Well, I think we don't pay enough attention or credit to the role of the First Nations in the colonization of Acadia. I mean, without the help of the First Nations, we wouldn't have survived, because they provided us with medicine that we didn't know for because of the scurvy. They provided us with how to prepare ourselves for really the climate, the geography. We were in little, what you would call, little cities in France. Arriving here, we had to get the knowledge of traveling the rivers, how to handle a canoe in the rivers. We had to also learn how to travel in the woods, because the First Nation taught us that usually in hardwood, the course would be the bark is thicker on the northern side of the tree. So you knew that you were going northwards by the thickness of the bark.
Oh, nice.
So, I mean, and also how to follow the stars and the moon. A lot of these, and how to catch fish, which birds that were edible. Most of the birds that the Acadians ate, seabirds, have First Nation names, like Moyak, Wubijou. These were all First Nations that taught us, and Acadians in most places do a lot of hunting, and they depend on wildlife. Not so much the new generation, but the generation of my father, there was an integral part of their nourishment was what they could get in the wild.
Conflict between the great nations across the Atlantic had far-reaching implications on the Acadians. France ceded mainland Nova Scotia and Newfoundland to the English and fortified the town of Louisbourg to serve as the capital of Ile Royale. The colony became the key to France's holdings in the New World.
People always think of the fur trade when they think of the development of Canada, but until the 1740s, the fisheries were the biggest economic booster for France in North America. And it makes sense that Placentia was such an important location because of its proximity to the Grand Banks. Ile Royale was kind of the second best. So when they lost access to Newfoundland and Placentia, they knew they needed to quickly establish another colony with that access to the Grand Banks fishery so they wouldn't lose that foothold that they'd gotten. And really, that's when Ile Royale takes off. And that's when it becomes important in their eyes.
Louisbourg became a major city in its own right, the colonial capital and a major trading center.
Louisbourg was incredibly culturally diverse. There's a huge Basque population that would have been speaking Basque. You've got Breton, you've got an Irish population, and then there's also a fairly large African community within Louisbourg because of slavery. So, yeah, it's an incredibly diverse community, and Acadians play a really interesting role in that.
One of the most important jobs that they were interpreters, because there were 7 official languages in Louisbourg. You know, people figure, well, there's only French. It's not true. There was, for example, the soldiers that were in Louisbourg spoke German. The Basque were around, so they spoke Basque. There was French, English, and there was 3 First Nation language. And most Acadians spoke the First Nations language. So they were asked to come to Louisbourg to do the trading. And they, of course, here on the island, there was a Basque settlement here. They used to fish out of here. So the people that worked with the Basque got to know their language. So they could very well function in 5. And so they were really, by the entrepreneurs, they were really a valuable commodity, you know. And one of the top interpreters really was a woman, a muse from the Pamlico areas, because she spoke very fluently the First Nation language, because one of her parents was First Nation, and understood Basque, French and English, because if you lived in Maine, what you would call on the mainland in Nova Scotia after 1720, you had to have contact with the English language.
In France, and even in Quebec during this period, it's really unusual for marriages to happen between 2 people who are almost of what we would call today different social classes. So if you're born in a laborer's family, usually you would marry someone who is of a similar background. But because the imbalance of the sexes was so strong here at Louisbourg, in the early days, 1 to 10 really is the ratio, there's an opportunity for women to marry in a social level that is above the one that they were born into, which is really wonderful. And there's also opportunities for people to work their way into higher social standings too. So someone who starts as a fisher might become a fishing proprietor and then might become involved in trade and become a tradesperson. So you see this kind of class jumping happen in Louisbourg and Ile Royale, and it doesn't happen in other places. For women, this is incredibly advantageous because at the time, women, when they're not married, aren't able to own property. So they're not able to run businesses before marriage or anything like that. So being able to marry into a higher social setting gives yourself a better opportunity. It opens you up to more opportunities, but also provides many more opportunities for your children in the future. People often think that's a funny way to look at marriage, but marriage in the 18th century is so much different.
It was a business contract back then.
Yeah, yeah. And really, if you're a woman who has the opportunity to provide a better life for your future children, why wouldn't you, right? It's an opportunity that most people can't give. So you'd take advantage.
Louisbourg's importance on Île Royale is unquestioned, but there were other communities on the island, some of which we can still visit today.
So all along the coast, you have these communities that still exist today. Saint-Esprit, Lourdes, Île Madame, that's when that starts to be populated. You've got Petite-Tigre, what is now Aréchat, and then Inganesh as well is settled as a fishing community. And really lots of other small little outposts around the island. But Louisbourg, because it's the capital of the colony, really retains a relationship with all of them. So if you're in Saint-Esprit, for example, and you have a legal issue, that has to go to the capital for it to be solved. And a lot of the trade that is happening, you see Louisbourg is such an important trade hub. And what would happen, ships would come from France, from Quebec, from the West Indies. They would meet at Louisbourg and goods would be distributed from there. So people would be taking their goods up to Louisbourg in order to sell them to other places and kind of make that trade loop and trade connection.
At first, conflict between the English and French was an ocean away. It happened elsewhere, and the people of Louisbourg took full advantage of their distance from Versailles to expand trade in ways the king might not have approved of.
Trade restrictions were in place, but especially leading up to 1744, there wasn't a significant amount of conflict between New England and the French colonies here. And trade just made sense for them. You're just down the coast. In a lot of situations, for example, they wanted the French in Île Royale to start boat building. But it never really picked up because it was always cheaper to import boats from New England than it was to make them here. So that kind of thing really went on. But you get trade connections between Acadia and Île Royale and New England throughout that whole initial period of the colony. And it makes sense, right? You're under, France is far away. So why not do what makes sense and is most advantageous to you? A lot of the people that were involved in trade in Île Royale were trading with New England just because it was advantageous to them. That kind of went south once war was declared in 1744, but up until then, what are you going to do?
It is during this period that the resource that would come to dominate Cape Breton's destiny first makes its appearance, with a tentative attempt at coal mining at Port Morion. The mine didn't catch on, as Sarah McGinnis explains.
The way that French colonialism worked was that the French crown really wanted the colonies to be dependent on them. So there wasn't a whole lot of support for these industries cropping up in the colonies. Colonies had certain purposes that they were meant to provide for, and that was it. But in 1720, you see a coal mine established at Port Morion, and that was established by the French. It wasn't long-lasting. It never had a major economic impact in Cape Breton for sure. But it's interesting that they made that push, that they recognized that that was an asset that they could work with, and that they made an attempt to start mining it and bring it in. It never really went anywhere. Like other industries that are tried here, like boat building, they just kind of faded out after a while. But It was in 1720 that first coal mine was established.
It was inevitable that the struggle between the two European powers would come to the New World, and soon, all-out war would come to Ile Royale's shores.
Well, we were really, what you would say, the results of European conflicts that led to the expulsion. In Quebec, the French Canadians there used to hire Iroquois to keep the English settlers in line by burning them and what have you. And of course here, because of the easier to get by boat, we were the one that got the kick in the rear end all the time, you know. So, and of course, given the situation with the War of Independence in the States, and the prosperity of Acadia, we became a prime target.
Louisbourg falls in 1758, and they begin deporting the French. But then, of course, once the French are gone, there's a need to keep a British presence here so that the French can't retake it. So the British maintain a presence. The next year, Quebec falls. Things kind of start falling into place. And over the decisions then made that Louisbourg is to be destroyed. British have already given it back to the French. They don't want that situation to ever arise again. So they decide they're going to systematically destroy the fortifications. So you end up with this British presence living in Louisbourg up until 1768, predominantly, just destroying the fortifications in the town.
After the fall of Louisbourg, the Acadians in Nova Scotia were forced from their homes and deported. History calls this event the expulsion. The Acadians call it Le Grand Dérangement.
And we were all spread all over. We were as far as the Falkland Islands off Argentina. There were Acadians that ended up there. Some came to Louisiana, and then more followed. But the reason we were allowed in Louisiana was that the Spanish were afraid that because of the manifest destiny of the U.S., that they were going to be taken over. And they wanted the people there, and Catholic people. So they welcomed us there in the bayous. But it was not a very good, it was a subsistence. And in the States where we ended up, we became what is called white slaves as opposed to equal partners.
Those are really difficult years, too, because you're taken away from that network that you had previously with the French colonies that are around you, the communities, and you're really forced inland, which is difficult when a lot of livelihood at the time comes from the sea, right?
The Mi'kmaq really saved our skins on many occasions. You know, they even lied for us, telling the British when they were doing the expulsion that, that village not to go in there because it had smallpox, you know, so the soldiers wouldn't go. But the real reason was that they were hiding Acadians. So yes, there is, and it's good to see that, especially the last couple of years, that there is a kind of a rapprochement, which it means that there is a getting together, especially in Grand Pré, where both cultures can be celebrated.
The Acadians lived for some 30 years in exile before making their way home. One of the founders of Shedicamp lived in Louisbourg. You can visit her house at the fortress today.
Jeanne Dugas spent a lot of her early childhood here in Louisbourg, and her home is actually reconstructed on the National Historic Site. So Jeanne had a difficult life for sure. While she was still living in Louisbourg, her home was impacted by a smallpox epidemic that broke out. So she lost her father and a number of her siblings. Her mother remarried and they moved away from Louisbourg. But Jeanne Dugas really has a holistic, I guess you'd say, Acadian experience in that she is forced to migrate around this region significantly in order to avoid deportation, and even is captured and taken to George's Island for a time in Halifax Harbor. But Jeanne Dugas, it's kind of amazing, she goes on to become a foundress of the community of Shedicamp. So this resiliency that we see even in the beginning of Louisbourg continues with people like Janduga and so many other Acadians. It's kind of incredible how many modern-day Cape Breton Acadians have connections to Louisbourg from the 18th century, from these people that are so notable, like Janduga.
One of them is noted to have walked the Appalachian Trail from South Carolina right up to Maine and back to Acadie, looking for the homestead, their old homestead. And when arriving there, found out that it was taken. And but what the Acadians did is that over time they inhabited places that the English did not want, like Ile Madame. You know, if you look at Ile Madame from a geographical point of view, there's not too much farming here. You either had to go to sea or you starved. Okay? So, and also Shetty Camp, and the first people in Shetty Camp, they inhabited the forest in the back. They used to call them the Montagneux. And the reason was is that if you were out of sight, out of mind.
Charles Roach is better known in and around Shetty Camp as Charlie Dan Roach. He works with the Père Charles Aucoin Genealogy Center in Shetty Camp.
They were afraid of further invasion, so they tended to hide from the shore. So as a general rule, they were setting behind the first row of hills where they couldn't be seen from the ocean. And we have a settlement in Petit Etang, which was not in view of the ocean, mm-hmm. and one in what we call the Platin, which is now Belle Marche, the back district of Shetty Camp. And there were a few houses on the isthmus going to the island, so the island hid them from view as well. And another factor was that they needed to be near water courses because they didn't have pumps, of course, and they didn't have time to dig wells or anything like that. So they settled where there was running water. And they needed hay for their animals. And in the marshlands, the hay was already growing. They didn't need to cut down trees and plant. So those were the motivating factors that led them to settle mostly offshore.
In 1790, 14 pioneers applied for a land grant in Shetty Camp. These pioneers are known as the 14 Old Ones, or Les Quatorze Vieux.
What we call the 14 Vieux are not the founders of Shetty Camp. They are the 14 people who signed the petition for the first land grant. And when they did that, there was more than 14 heads of families in the area. There was probably around 25 or so. So they applied for a land grant, not only for themselves, but in the name of all the other people in the community. I might mention that, contrary to most people, when our Acadians applied for that land grant, they didn't apply for individual grants. They applied for a communal grant, 7,000 acres, which was huge. It went from Pine Cross all the way down to the entrance to the national park. And they then divided that among themselves in their own way without having recourse to legal procedures. That caused some confusion in subsequent generations. But eventually, clear titles were established for all the properties.
Cape Breton was, at the time of the Acadians' return, sparsely populated and, to most people, had little in the way of potential. However, a group of entrepreneurs from the island of Jersey saw riches in the waters off Cape Breton. Charles Robin came to the island and formed a company that would come to dominate Acadian life until the 20th century.
When the Robins came in 1765, after so-called the deportation of Grand Arrangement, they were told that there was a group of Acadians living with the First Nations on Cape Breton Island. They went and got them. And they set them up with chalupes, gear, helped them build a shelter. But the thing is this, that they paid them with jetons. And jetons is like Canadian Tire money, where it's only good negotiable at Canadian Tire store. Mm-hmm. And to them, they paid them with what you would call monies, that their own money, that they could only negotiate at the Robin store. They also had the idea that the chaloupe and all that belong to the Robins. Upon hitting the floor of the boat, the fish did no longer belong to you. It belonged to the Robins.
The Robins were here I think about 1770 or thereabouts. We have evidence to suggest that they were here at least then, maybe earlier. And of course, one of the reasons that that there is a Shedika is because of the robins being here. The robins could provide all the necessities of life that the people could not make for themselves, like molasses and rum, which was very popular, tobacco. They couldn't get those. They couldn't grow these things here. So they had to get them from overseas. And the robins, of course, went as far as the West Indies to with their fish. And on their way back, they would bring all those commodities. And whatever the people could not make for themselves, they got from the robin store. And there was also somebody to buy their fish. The robins were already equipped to process the fish. And if it hadn't been for that, our people couldn't have earned a living. They arrived here with nothing. The robins provided the fishing gear, the boats, and everything else at the beginning. And of course, that's a two-edged sword. It was at the expense of being economic slaves of the robins. They decided at what price the fish was going to sell, and they decided the prices of the things they were providing to the people. So they would advance them on credit during the whole winter for whatever they needed. And come springtime, they were already in debt with the robins company for the fish they were going to catch, not the fish they had caught, the fish they were going to catch. So they couldn't decide to whom they were going to sell their fish and at what price. It had to go to the robins at the price that they decided. So come the fall season, when they would settle the accounts, if the Acadians were lucky, they would end up square. If they were unlucky, they'd end up in the hole. But they very seldom came in the clear. And they didn't have money. They were always broke.
Now, the people in Petit Gras here, we were known as the mangeurs d'arête, you know, that fish bone eaters. And the reason was very typical. We ate the heads and the main bone where we took home, which was the, in order to dry the fish, you had to take the main bone out and cut the head. And that's what we ate. And that's how we got our nickname historically as the mangeurs d'arête, because the robins would not allow us to take around fish home.
In Shedikan, to my knowledge, I think the Jersey people were limited to the robins. Of course, they brought in workers to work for them. And that was quite another thing. They would bring in people in their teens, late teens, early 20s maybe. They were full of life. And they were here for a contract of maybe 3 or 4 years without the right to marry, because they wanted them to be complete service to the company. They were here and wanting to have fun, prime of life. So they like to play tricks on our people. They told the people that they had sorcery powers, and they could put curses on them, and they were scared of the robins. They had a ball at the expense of the credibility of the people.
When the grip of the robins loosened shortly after the dawn of the 20th century, an opportunity for education arose, but these early efforts had consequences.
We are the first generation to be educated, but we were educated that when we arrived in grade 12, we were what you would call linguistic bastards. We could write English, hardly speak it. We could read it, but we couldn't speak it. We spoke French home all the time and within the community. And our French at home, we couldn't read it, and we couldn't write it.
It is true that a lot of our people couldn't read or write, although their spoken vocabulary was very, very precise.
Paradoxically, these communities developed a language and culture all their own in their isolation, rooted both in their dependence on the ocean and traditions dating back to the regions of France where their forebears were born.
We had a vocabulary that was based on the marine life, because everything around here turned around the sea. Fishing was the one industry on which the community was based, and everything else tended to go that way. I'll give you a few examples. For example, we still say chavirer son verre, to spill a glass of water. We say chavirer. The proper French is renverser. Mm-hmm. But chavirer is the right word to use if you're talking about a boat that overturned. So a boat overturned, le bateau a chaviré. Anyway, another aspect of our language is what we call le son chrétien, which is the CH sound of champion or church. We tend to say, make that sound of all the words that have a C or a Q in them. For example, we say we don't say le cœur for the heart. We say le cœur, the CH sound of champion again. Where that came from? From back France. When our people came here in the 1600s, from the Poitou and Saint-Auge and Louny, that's how they were speaking back then in those regions. So it's proof of where we came from, and it remained here because of the isolation.
If you look at how certain groups, due to isolation, speak a typical language, they would have a different patois, which is normal. You know, when we were here for years, we didn't have l'Académie Française to tell us, you know, how to structure our sentences. We were lucky, thanks to the nuns that spoke to us in French, that we started going to school. Because my father he said he only replaced his brother when his brother was sick to go to school. Because in those days, if you could fit into a rubber boat, you were fishing.
It wasn't just the language that the Acadians of Cape Breton preserved. One tradition that has survived until modern times in Shetty Camp is a celebration to mark the halfway point of Lent that dates back to medieval France. This festive time is known as Mi-Carême.
Mi-Carême literally means mid-Lent. And, of course, in the early days, the population here was entirely Catholic and French. And the observance of the penance of Lent was something that people did very respectfully of the church. And it got to a point that they weren't allowed to have dances or eat fatty foods or whatever for 40-some days. That's a long stretch. So around the middle of the Lent, the people couldn't put up with it anymore. So they decided to go back to the Mardi Gras celebrations and have more fun. And the church tolerated one day. They were allowed to have some fun. And like I said, they would dress up in old rags and go from house to house, visit their friends and neighbors, and tease them as much as they could without being recognized. And now we've stretched it to the whole week. we don't have the penance of Lent anymore, but we have the pleasures of Mi-Carême.
Every family had almost an orchestra. And here, especially during Mi-Carême, it was really a breakaway from fast and abstinence during Lent. It was halfway. So a week they would do Mi-Carême and Arshad, another week in Petit de Gras, another week, and then the people from Petit de Gras go to Arshad because they knew each other. And of course, that night when they dance with the Mi-Carême, and the jester at the Mi-Carême is trying to figure out who that person behind the mask was. And of course, some girls would come in figuring that it was their boyfriends, and they danced with the person and all that. And perhaps only to discover later on that it wasn't, you know. So this is it was more or less a gaiety type of thing too. Because, I mean, they had hard, life was hard. And they played, you know, they partied hard.
Like other groups that call Cape Breton home, the Acadians have taken to the fiddle as the party instrument of choice.
Acadian fiddling is a little livelier. The Scottish is more lament, yeah. But the Acadians is lighter and more gaiety and faster. And you had to be in shape to keep it up. But like you said, they fished all year. They drank hard and they fought hard and they danced hard.
Shetty Camp, although we are very French to the core, we have produced a great number of fiddlers that can easily sit by any Scottish fiddler and play the same music and you can't tell the difference. People like Joe Cormier, who just passed away recently, our Timac Boudreau, as we call him, Donnie LeBlanc, the names just don't come to mind right now, but we have many, many fiddlers. So Arthur Muse, of course, the famous Arthur Muse. He could play with any Scottish fiddler and you would be able to tell the difference. And it's to the point that it is said that he listened so much to people like Winston Scotty Fitzgerald and Angus Chisholm that he would listen to their tapes, and if they made a mistake, he would make the same mistake and play. He thought it was part of the music.
Thank you.
Around the middle of the century came a rediscovery of Acadian culture.
We started really with building institutions in the 70s. You know, like the offshoot of the Quiet Revolution did here, where we believed, and we still do, that unless you feel a sense of pride in your own skin, if you do that, you will get somewhere else. And also, if you get to know your culture, another person's culture is not going to be threatening. As a matter of fact, you're going to look at it as in a positive light.
When I was a child, we barely knew about Arishat and the rest of Richmond County. We had no communications. We barely knew about the Magdalen Islands. But in modern times, we started having exchange of cultures and gatherings of people from all over. And that's when the pride and the interest in Acadian culture, I think, got a big boost. Okay. When people like Edith Butler and Angèle Arsenault and Dona Lacroix, when these people started producing music, at first they started singing traditional songs. Then they went into their own compositions. But they started their careers singing our folk songs. That's how they got a new life.
Beyond music and mi-karam, another art form that the Acadians excelled at was rug hooking. The most famous practitioner of the art was a woman from Sherry Camp named Elizabeth Lefort.
Elizabeth Lefort, I'm proud to say, was my neighbor when I grew up. She was of the generation of my parents, of course. And to tell you how wonderful a woman she was and how simple she was, I have a little story that I think illustrates the point very well. When I grew up, women stayed in the home. There was no such thing as women careers. And my own mother went out of the house to go to the doctor to do maybe a little bit of grocery shopping. And that was about it in church. She heard that Elizabeth Lefort was hooking the portrait of Queen Elizabeth II and that she was going to present that portrait to the Queen in person. So it was a big, big issue. So she called Elizabeth and she said, when you're finished, you should come and show me your work. I'd like to see it. So my mother saw that tapestry of Queen Elizabeth II before the Queen did. That was Elizabeth Lefort. She never forgot her roots. She was down to earth. And as far as she was concerned, we were more important in her life than the celebrities that she was making portraits of. So she was a very simple woman, but with a great talent. And she was discovered, of course, by Kenneth Ansford, and he's the one who promoted her career and made her known to the world. And she became world famous, like you said. She was called Canada's Artisan Wool. She did with wool what people mostly do with oil paintings, which is hard to believe. We're very proud to have in this building, Les Trois Pignons, a gallery bearing her name, and we've preserved I don't remember, but I think it's 25 or so more of her major works, including the Resurrection, the history of Canada, and the history of the U.S., huge tapestries, and many portraits of famous people like all the astronauts in the early exploration going to the moon and that sort of thing. So she was a fantastic woman, yes, indeed. And she was honored by being a member of the Order of Canada. She had a doctorate degree from the University of Moncton, and, you know, she was really something.
As you travel through Acadian communities, you may see a star proudly displayed on many a house. This star, L'Étoile de la Mer, holds a special place in Acadian culture.
The star is the Blessed Mother, who guided the Acadians and became the patron saints of the Acadians, and that's why she is on French flag with the star on the corner. It is the star of Mary. Yeah, L'Étoile de la Mer is called because of their voyage across and also during the deportation. So it became very significant, and it still is significant to us.
Today, Acadian culture is alive and well, nurtured by new French schools and community groups dedicated to all things Acadian.
Over the years, we have established tools that can work in the preservation of the culture. The FAN, the Federation of Acadians of Nova Scotia, is there to fight for our rights and to make sure that that our rights are respected. The fact that we have French schools now in Chénicamp and in Richmond County as well, and in Sydney and in Halifax. That is all due to the fact that the FAN is there fighting for our rights. If they weren't there, we wouldn't have had this. Now the province of Nova Scotia is getting more and more from the point of view of accepting French as a richness to the province rather than a burden, and they're starting to grant us rights even before we ask. There's more and more French services provided by the province, and that's all due to the fact that the FAN is there. Here in Chedicamp, we have our radio station, which has done wonders to preserve the language and the culture and to promote local artists in French. We have several of our young singers that are now writing their own music in French. We never would have dreamed of that 25 years ago. The radio station provided that. There was a time when nobody would listen to CBC French music, because it was there, but it was not listened to, because people didn't have the ear for it. They didn't have the taste for it. After our radio station opened, we started playing local artists in French and mixing it with Quebec artists, and some from France, some from Belgium. Now they're listening to French music, and they love it. That 25 years ago, that would not have been possible. So we've established tools over the years to help us in the preservation of the culture, and especially to make people proud of the culture. And we have a great tourism industry here, and one of the main reasons that we do is because people from the United States in particular, and from Western Canada, they want to see what an Acadian village is like. They want to hear people talk their archaic French language. They want to hear the music, and that's an attraction. Our rugged industry is another aspect that attracts people here. So tourism has become one of the major industries in the area.
I would like to believe that in time, that given the fact that locally here, that it is the Acadians that are the economic motors of the community, that they will expand and provide meaningful work, fish plant work, but work that would give you a decent salary, that you can be able to build your own house and you can have decent living, that is not taking three or four working at the plant to survive. That is my wish, and in every part of Cape Breton as well, because that's really what's happening in Cape Breton, is that we're educating our kids for somebody else, and it's sad. But given that the primary resources are no longer here, we have to go and diversify. And hopefully we will get people that will do exactly that.
Have you ever been here where the cool Atlantic air whispers like I did, though so far away from here? Over 200 years and 1,000 bitter tears, I failed to drown the pride of Lacadie. A woman, child, and man were taken from their land by men who got their orders from men beyond our borders. Sweethearts watch from the shore, their loves to hold no more, as they sail from their hearts in Lacadie. Here our children play, and we know they are here to stay, where their fathers return to their children and their lovers, sail back to the heart of Lacadie. And 1,000 bitter tears, the tongues that gave the orders are threatening our borders, and a powerful few with blood like me and you should have learned a thing or two from Lacadie. hear our children playing, and we know they are here to stay, where their fathers return to their children and their lovers, sail back to the heart of Black Ivy. Children playing, and we know they are here to stay, where their fathers return to their children and their lovers, sail back to the heart of Black Ivy. A place for you and me is Black Ivy. Pour toi et moi et l'Acadie.
A special thanks to La Picasse in Petit de Gras, Gabriel LeBlanc, Charlie Dan Roach, and Sarah McGinnis at The Fortress. Merci beaucoup to Le Monde. Next time on The Story of Home, the British are coming.
Curating Cape Breton's Multicultural Mosaic, a dedication to diversity past and present, is a Coast 89.7 original production. We would like to thank the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Radio Meters program for its financial support of this series.